The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, so yesterday we had a retreat, and at our retreat center, we had I taught a week-long retreat together with Richard Shankman. So we need a little bit louder out there. How's that? Louder now? Not louder? Because it's pretty loud in here for me. That's good. But how about the rest of you out there? Can you hear out there? Yeah? Yeah, so it's... Tom, you're going to have to move. So, so the theme for this last week was something called anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing in and breathing out. If you go back to the most ancient records of Buddhism that have the claim to be perhaps the closest we get to what the Buddha actually taught and what he actually did, there is only one meditation practice the Buddha refers to as the practice that he did. And that's mindfulness of breathing, meditation on breath. And down through the centuries, it's one of the, probably one of the... All these extra sounds today. Still screwing. So, down through the centuries, meditation on the breath is probably qualifies as one of the most, if not the most, popular Buddhist form of meditation. Certainly popular in many different Buddhist traditions. I was introduced to it in Zen, and probably started meditating, focusing on my breath when I was 20, 21, and I'm still doing it. And it takes a long time to learn how to breathe. And one of the nice surprises about my now almost 40 years of meditating on my breath is it gets more interesting. So you think, you know, you do the same thing, you know, one, two breaths, maybe three breaths, and you kind of get the idea, you're breathing. But to do it, you know, day after day after day after day, months for years, it would think that it gets kind of boring after a while. But in fact, it's the opposite. It gets more interesting for me as time goes along. And it isn't because the breath in and of itself is interesting, breathing in and of itself is interesting, but rather the whole process of breathing resides at the hub of so much of our lives. And as we connect to our breathing, that hub opens up to a wide spectrum of our life and becomes a wonderful lubricant for our lives. Becomes a kind of the thing that keeps us fluid and relaxed, can keep us fluid and relaxed through whatever's going on. You probably all know, you know, the common phenomena of holding one's breath if we're tense or afraid. And if you've taken a yoga class, it seems like one of the most common things yoga teachers will say is, remember to breathe. You know, you're not breathing. What do you mean I'm not breathing? I'm still alive. But in fact, you know, with the kind of these postures in yoga, sometimes we do hold you, some of us hold our breath. And then sometimes it feels, we have, you know, we talk in our language, various expressions of what it feels like when we finally can breathe. You know, I can finally breathe out. It was, you know, finally, you know, everything was going well. Things you were worried about are no longer worrying, and you breathe out, or your tension is gone, and you can feel your breathing relax again. If we focus on the breath, pay attention to the breath, we tend to know where we're holding, when we're holding. And it's a little bit more difficult to hold the breath or constrict the breath if we're paying attention to it. It tends to lubricate or open it up. If the breathing is more open, goes more fluid, that keeps everything else more fluid. It's harder for the mind to get attached, to cling, to resist, to get kind of obsessed in something. And the mind that's not obsessed is a mind that's much more at ease. So in the Buddhist tradition, it's said that the meditation practice on breathing can lead to full awakening. I had a teacher in Japan who said that the mindfulness of breathing, meditation, and breath is in and of itself enough to lead to awakening. It's a very powerful practice. And I would say that probably some of the greatest joy and pleasure that I've had in my life has come from meditating on the breath. And some of the greatest experiences of peace, well-being, compassion, and love comes in the wake of the practice of meditating on the breath. I think it's very, very powerful, wonderful thing to do. It's not the right practice for everyone. So just keep that in mind. There's treasure chest full of different meditation practices for different people, different ones suited for the various people. Now, if you go back to the earliest teachings, there are some particular instructions for how to practice with breathing. And the most detailed meditation instructions in the early Buddhist tradition, it could be said, depending how you interpret the texts, but could be said to be around breathing. And that's what I want to do this evening. This is what we did on the retreat. They talk about 16 steps to focusing on the breath. And it begins before the first step. It says, a person goes to the forest under a tree or to an empty building. So our building qualifies as an empty building, empty enough for meditation. And you go there, and we go, and the first thing to do is to sit upright. And the expression sitting upright, I take both as literally useful and also as a metaphor. Literally useful, it's generally good to sit, if you can, with your spine, your back, a little bit straighter than you normally would. There's something very powerful about the posture, human posture. And this, I think, is part of what they recognized in ancient India in the yogic asanas, the postures that people take. And it's understood that the cross-legged position is an asana, is actually a yogic posture to take. For those sitting in a chair, the yogic posture of meditation is to sit upright. Don't rely 100% on the backrest of the chair. Use the backrest enough so that you don't continue injuring your back if you have a back injury. But there's something very significant about sitting upright and being self-reliant. The energy, the sense of independence, and there's a sense of presence that comes when we sit upright. There's a kind of a loss of some sense of presence when we kind of collapse into a chair. And then in this upright posture, then it's also a metaphor for being somehow independent, for being an upright person, for being willing to face and be present for what our experiences of our life are. And then the instructions are to establish mindfulness. And here, establish mindfulness doesn't mean that we direct the mindfulness to anything particular, but rather that we create a sense of presence or awareness that's available to be here and take in what's going on in our experience. So some people say that if they relax their preoccupations with the concerns of the day or their fantasies or their emotions, if they relax, then in that relaxed state that follows, we're naturally going to be aware, we're going to establish awareness. And then it says, then it begins the 16 steps of what to do. And each step involves breathing mindfully in and mindfully out. And that's the constant that goes through all 16 steps. And this constancy of the breath, staying with the breath over and over again, no matter what goes on, staying with the breath, being with the breath. I've been in difficult conversations and meetings and different things where it would have been easy to get tense, and I make it a practice to stay with my breathing, stay present. And you might think that if I stay with my breath, I'm not going to be present for the meeting and what's going on. But I'm actually much better present than if I get caught up in my emotions, my preoccupations, and my distracted mind. It keeps me kind of, as I said earlier, fluid or relaxed in a situation. Staying with the breath, breathe mindfully to what's going on. Keep it constant. It can be very comforting to have the constancy of the breath as your companion. With time, the focusing on the breath becomes a comforting refuge, and it becomes some place we can go and feel connected, feel grounded, feel like we're in the present moment, and not as easily pulled into our concerns, pulled into the events around us in a way that's not useful. So having this constancy, it's likened sometimes to the ballast of a boat. You're not going to be knocked over too easily if you have a good ballast. The breathing, the constancy of it is the ballast that keeps you kind of on course, keeps you from getting caught up. So each of these 16 steps, what they all have in common, it says breathing in and breathing out. Breathing in mindfully, breathing out mindfully. That's what's kuskun. And then it directs in those 16 steps to pay attention to 16 different areas of our life. And these 16 areas are divided into groups of four, and they're called the four tetrads, the 16. And these groups of four have something in common. There's a structure to them a little bit. And part of the structure is they end, each of the four, the fourth one, ends with some practice or some experience that's in the family of phenomena we call letting go. And there's many things connected or associated with letting go. But somehow they're connected to letting go, all of them. And so the first one of those groups of four is the foundation for the letting go, that's the fourth one. So the first one directs our attention to some foundation, some area of our life that we establish ourselves in. We get to know it, we kind of go through the next two steps, and then there's some aspect of letting go. So the first tetrad begins by you focus on your breathing, and you simply know the experience of breathing. You get to know it better. They say it in a kind of, in some ways maybe uninspiring way. That it says, when you're breathing in long, know you're breathing in long. When you're breathing in short, know you're breathing in short. When you're breathing in long, know you're breathing in long. When you're breathing out long, know you're breathing out long. When you're breathing in short, know you're breathing in short. When you're breathing out short, know you're breathing out short. You know, people get pretty tired quickly if that's all they do. Is that was short, that was long. And at the retreat, someone, at some point raised their hand, wait a minute, short, long, my breath is medium. What am I supposed to do? I'm left out. The idea is not to only recognize whether you're breathing, have a long breath or a short breath, but to start becoming, to use the breath as a place to train the mind to be present. And anybody who meditates can recognize how easy it is for the mind to wander off. And so you keep coming back, and not only trying to be present, but in that present moment experience, the idea is to develop our capacity to see more clearly what's going on. And that's the hallmark of mindfulness meditation, is to begin to see and understand what's happening. And so the first, and that happens by beginning to look and recognize what the characteristics are of your breathing. Is it short? Is it long? Is it fast? Is it slow? Is it shallow? Is it deep? Do you breathe in a jerky way? Do you breathe in a smooth way? Do you breathe, what part of your body is active and activated or energized when you breathe? Some people breathe more in the chest, some people in the movement's more in the belly. Some people mostly feel the sensations of the air going in and out through the nostrils. What goes on? What kind of movements? What kind of activity of breathing happens for you? How do you understand it? And when I was in Burma, practicing this practice in Burma, I had to go and for an interview with a teacher every day. And every day he expected me to fill in the details of how I was experiencing the breathing and all the different sensations that came into the breathing. So if you're doing this day after day after day, all day long, there started to be dozens of sensations, that I was aware of as I breathed. At first there was only one, in, out was kind of all I could tell. But then they started coming alive, and there was a kaleidoscope of many, many things going on as I breathed. And it got very fascinating to turn in and become aware of that. So it's a training in being present and a training in sharpening our capacity to see the details of what our experience is. Part of that training of the details is to begin not only to be present, but to cease, to stop, the often incessant conceptualizing that the mind makes. The commentary, the judgments, the kind of generalizations we make about our experience, and to get underneath the generalizations to actually feel the experience itself. So we get to know the breath. Then the letting go part of this whole exercise, the last part of the first tetrad, is to relax your body. So you use your breath to get established, to be here. Then it tells you, get to know your body, open up the awareness and feel your body, and then relax your body. And I think this is often a common thing, that if you start being in the present moment, concentrated, focused, stop being so distracted, it's pretty common for people to start developing a heightened awareness of what's going on in the body. And one of the things to become aware of, and kind of happens naturally, that if your body is tense, if there's holding in your body, that you become aware of it. And then the instructions are, relax your body. Soften it. That's pretty nice, right? If you're tense. And so that first tetrad ends, the letting go practice is the practice of relaxing the body. Let it be soft. You can relax the belly, you can relax the shoulders, the face. It's all over the body. There can be small muscles, large muscle groups that it's possible to relax. Not to relax in such a way that you lose the uprightness, because the upright posture is a way to stay alert. If you relax and collapse, you'll probably fall asleep. The second tetrad begins by, so there's the foundation for it, begins by saying, feel well-being. Feel some sense of joy or good feelings. And that, with that as a foundation, the last step in that second tetrad is relax your mental activities. So the first one, the first tetrad is by relaxing the body. Now it's relaxing the mental activities. So if you keep this meditation going, at some point you become aware that your mind is active. And you might be thinking about things you don't need to think about. Not only thinking about things you don't need to think about, but you're thinking about them incessantly, actively, energetically, with attachment. There might be a lot of other activities in the mind, besides just the thoughts themselves. There might be emotions and feelings and desires and aversions and grumpiness and, you know, all kinds of things that go on in there. And so this process of the second tetrad is to have some, with some sense of well-being, joy, begin to appreciate what's going on in your mind. And the joy is important, so when you start recognizing what goes on in your mind, you don't get depressed. Because self-knowledge is seldom good news. You know, we start seeing what goes on, what makes us tick. And so how do you get a sense of well-being? That's the first step. One way to do it is to appreciate the good feelings that come when you relax your body. If you hold your hand really tight in a tense fist for quite a while, and then you release the fist, you probably feel a sense of relief, lightness, kind of warm, nice feelings in your hand, just from that releasing that goes on. As we begin relaxing the shoulders, the muscles, and everything kind of begins to soften in meditation, then there can start being, could be quite subtle at first, some feelings that feel kind of good inside, feelings of well-being. And it's not always automatic that people begin taking that in, registering it and feeling that those feelings of well-being or joy or the goodness that comes with relaxation. And so here, the instructions are to start feeling the consequences of getting relaxed and concentrated. And those consequences that have to do with feeling something good, feeling nice inside. Some people who meditate and are Buddhist practitioners somehow feel like they're not allowed to feel the good things in meditation. You're supposed to always be kind of, you know, that's maybe dangerous of being, you might get attached. You might get attached to them, or, you know, you're only meditating if you're suffering. you know, really kind of bearing down and trying hard. But in fact, the deeper movements of freedom for the mind in meditation unfold much better when we cultivate a sense of well-being, joy, happiness. So the second tetrad has to do with developing the joy and the happiness. Doesn't have to be much, a modicum of it. Enough so that when you look at your mind, your mental activities, and what you see, whatever you see there, you're less likely to get upset, depressed, discouraged by what you see. Because, you know, we're a mixed bag, right? And then what's interesting is we start becoming familiar with our mental activity, our inner life, and instead of judging it, instead of attacking it, or the instructions are, relax your mental activity. Just lighten up. soften the mind, the mental activity. Quiet the thinking that you, if you can. The third tetrad, the foundation of it, where it begins, is now, and it's more subtle, and now don't feel the mental activities, but now tune in to the state of your mind, or the quality of your inner life, the general state of consciousness that you're in, or the general mood of your heart, kind of the more the state that we're in. And this becomes a shift. Some people are so focused on the activities of the mind, their desires, their wants, their concerns, that we don't really notice that well the quality of our inner life. The quality of our inner life, the state of our mind, is one of the most precious resources we have, and it's something to cultivate and care for well if we want to care for ourselves. And so now the instructions are, notice the state of your mind. And then instructions are, notice or develop some satisfaction, some sense of being pleased or happy with your practice, with yourself, with what's going on. So again, the emphasis here again is feel good about what's going on. And then concentrate the mind. The state of mind, now we can kind of a sense of the wider mood or atmosphere of the inner, or the heart, or the mind. Let it start getting unified, gathered and collected, so that it kind of feels like you're in this bubble of awareness, a bubble of presence. So we're not scattered and the mind's not kind of jumping around and easily distracted, but begins settling down, getting composed. So settle and steady the mind. So feel the mind, steady the mind. And then, very interesting, that the fourth part of this, the letting go family of activities, it says, start becoming aware. As you breathe in, you breathe out, start becoming aware of how the mind is liberated or free. Not that you have to be a totally liberated Buddha, but as you kind of settle in and steady the mind and no longer caught up in the particular concerns that you have, and the state of the mind becomes more open, more expansive, more spacious. A meditative mind feels quite expansive, big. They talk about big mind. And it starts becoming a mind that is not caught by its concerns, not caught by what we want, what we don't want, what we're afraid of, what we're worried about. And that feeling of not being caught, not being hijacked or held hostage by all these inner forces of desire and aversion and fear and restlessness and doubt, is a kind of liberation, a kind of experience of the mind not being caught. And so the instruction is, get to know what it's like for the mind not to be caught. In the smallest ways, whatever way you can, start appreciating what this is like. Because the appreciation of what it's like for mind not to get caught, it shows you the way, supports you, to go become freer and freer in meditation and in your life. It shows you the path. So then, in the fourth tetrad, again, we're still just breathing in and breathing out. And some of this happens kind of more, I don't know if naturally is the right word, but can just kind of follow as we get more and more concentrated and settled. The fourth tetrad begins with noticing impermanence, noticing how things change. Notice a change in quality of things. And the context for noticing that is to be aware of that in a mind that is relaxed, open, and spacious. With a mind that's relaxed, open, and spacious, start becoming aware that all the events, the activities, the experiences we have moment by moment are changing and fleeting. And so in that changing nature of things, some of those things we begin getting disinterested in, disinterested in pursuing, being involved in. So, for example, in meditation, it might take a while, but at some point you'll get sick of your thinking. You know, enough of this. And you'll start losing interest. These thoughts, they come and go, but then they come and go again, and they come and go again. And so at some point you start recognizing this incessant nature of some of the concerns we have, and there's a tendency of losing interest, relaxing around that way. Some of the things that, some of the particular events in our life that we've been obsessing about for a long time, we begin to lose our interest in them. So there's something about seeing the incessant arising and passing of phenomena over and over again that helps the mind become disinterested, not because we're becoming kind of disinterested also can mean have a negative connotation. I like to think of it as becoming disenchanted in the experience. And with that disinterest, there starts to becoming a lessening involvement in the things that we're attached in our mind. And then at some point, we're no longer involved, no longer caught, no longer attached to some of the things we were caught up in. So say that you have a lot of desire, and your mind is driven by desire. And you see yourself always desiring, desiring. Or say that you're driven by the need to prove yourself or have an identity or strong ideations and thoughts about self, self-criticism or self-aggrandizement or how to prove yourself, how to defend yourself, how to justify yourself. There's all these things that we go on in the mind. They rise and they pass. And we start becoming disinterested in them. And then, in part to become disinterested in them because we see the difference between a mind that's caught and a mind that's spacious and not caught. At some point, some of the things we were concerned about are so thoroughly not there. And we have an experience of a mind or heart or way of being not caught. And then comes a very special moment. And this is the last step of the 16. And this is, we make a decision, or the heart makes a decision. I'm done with that. I'm done with that. Enough. So, you know, you've been obsessing about certain kind of thing, some anything at all, and it seemed very interesting, compelling for a long time. But you go through this process of getting disinterested in it, get in this process of beginning appreciating, you have something much better going on, you have a relaxed, open, spacious mind and heart. And then the thing that you were obsessing about, you stop obsessing, and when you really feel how good it feels not to obsess, then this wonderful moment of, it's often called relinquishment, enough of that. Isn't that nice? I'm done with that. And I imagine that most of you have come to some point in your life and thought, I'm done with that. And sometimes maybe it's only after the fact. You look back and say, I haven't done that for a long time, but I don't want to do that again. You know, like some of the things you were concerned about in high school. You know, some of us, you know, I'm done with that. You know, no more of that. So those are the 16 steps. So they all, each of the tetrads ends with a kind of aspect of letting go. Two of them are called relaxation, relaxing the body, relaxing the mind. The third one is appreciating a mind which is not caught. So it's let go enough that the mind is not caught in the things. It feels spacious, open, relaxed. Being aware of what that's like. And the fourth one ends with having let go enough, or thoroughly enough, that we see that we have some choice about whether or not we invest ourselves into those things again in the future. And in that seeing that choice, there can be a choice to, I'm done, enough of that. It might come back, of course, but it's to actually feel that turning of the heart, the turning of the mind, I'm not going to do that anymore. I don't want to be involved in that anymore. That's a huge deal to come to that point. And then it might take practice in a while to really kind of shed it or not get caught in it again. And all that process is done by breathing in and breathing out. Breathing in and breathing out. So I hope that, I don't know if this going through 16 stages like this is interesting for a talk. It was interesting for a 7-day retreat where we kind of did it slowly over the days, and kind of once, you know, a few steps at a time. And we did them as kind of guided meditations, so they kind of, so it wasn't just kind of listening to a long list going on and on. And I think it was quite meaningful for many people. I found it very meaningful for myself, this practice of breathing. So I don't know if I was able to convey that to you. You don't have to remember all this that I said, except keep in mind that this whole process does involve relaxing. Relaxing the body, relaxing the mind, and sooner or later appreciating what it's like to have a heart, mind, which has let go deeply and well, and that from the vantage point of having let go deeply and well, to make a decision. I'm done with certain things. I'm done with that. That's not meant to be an aversion towards things, but rather a movement of wisdom. You've had seconds, and then thirds, and then fourths, and you're bloated and full. I'm done. You know, that's not aversion. It's like, that just... So you've watched television for 16 hours straight. You know, I'm done. You know, you realize, you know, 16 hours watching the shopping channel or something. And I'm done, you know. So, I mean, I'm just being silly with these examples, but, you know, you probably have your own obsession or thing that you're doing that... You know, it's often something that you don't really want other people to know that you do. You know, if you have something that you'd rather not other people know that goes on in your mind, I venture to bet that if you do this process of deep relaxation, meditation, you'll come to the day where you'll feel done with it. I don't want to do that anymore. So, we have 5 minutes. Do you want to say anything about this or ask questions about it? Or
so sometimes I'll read, or it's usually stuff I find in books about being completely disgusted with
16 hours of TV.
16 hours of TV.
Nonstop.
Life, craving, wanting things. And sometimes when I read it, it just sounds really nihilistic, and it sounds like there's actually a lot of aversion. It's like they go on, like, you know, disgusted, and it's like rotting corpse, and on and on, like this, like in Buddhist texts. Are they really just alluding to this just that enough. Setting us more, what you're saying sounds more neutral, just sort of.
Yeah, so what Phil is pointing out is that there are some of the classic Buddhist texts, ancient texts, that does use kind of seemingly very negative language, like the word disgust, being disgusted with certain things. But that's it. Partly that's a problem of translation. There have been, even like there's one translator changed his translation. He had, for a while, he used revulsion. But then he's changed it now, and I think he has a much better translation, and that is disenchanted. So, you know, I have to be a little bit careful with the English words. Disenchanted means that you've been enchanted. You're caught in a spell. So it's good to get disenchanted. But some of the language that's seemingly very negative and world-negating or body-negating and variety of things which are, is there, sometimes you have to look at the context in which it's being taught. And there are passages in the texts where they say, look upon the body as a disease, as a boil, as, you know, as disgusting and things like that. But the context of it is deep meditation where there is more joy, happiness, and pleasure than most people will ever experience. A tremendous, tremendous feeling of well-being. And in that, it's in that context to some of that language being used, because partly, I believe, partly because the contrast is so great. And in when there's such purity of mind, and the mind is going further, it just doesn't feel good at all to do some of the things that you're doing before. So if you have spent 7 days on retreat, and you spend, you know, 4 or 5 days finally kind of taming the mind, so it's not just wild and running all over, and my mind's finally settled in the present moment. And then as it settles more and more in the present moment, its mind starts feeling more and more joy, peace, happiness, sense of purity, ease. And it becomes more and more so, and you feel like there's thoughts, but the thoughts just kind of whisk by, and you don't feel like you're so interested in them and caught by them. And the mind just feels so, so peaceful, calm, and there's a deep, deep sense of rest. Sometimes on retreat, people have feeling of rest that they've, you know, some people are exhausted from a lifetime of mental activity. And so they have deep rest, deep purity, deep everything. It's the sixth day of the retreat. It's really good. You've never had it so good before. And your best friend comes to the retreat center and says, you know, I'm taking you because we're going to go to a tailgate party at Candlestick Park with, you know, all my biker friends. And we're going to, you know, drink beer and listen to heavy metal music. And I don't know if being disgusted is the right expression for that. But, you know, it might have been fun, you know, when you were back in your old days, distracted and caught up in your thoughts and, you know, and kind of feeling lonely and want to be with your friends. But after the sixth day of the retreat, it's like, ooh, you know, I don't want to do that. So the very dramatic language that you're referring to is in the context of that kind of meditative experience. And it's been it's taught not so much to have any aversion to the world, but rather to protect and enhance and continue developing this beautiful state of heart and mind that can be had, to help with the relinquishment. You know, I'm done with certain things. So I don't know if that helps you with the question, but the context is important for that kind of language. That makes some sense?
It does. Actually, that happened to me. I went to a day-long this weekend and was invited to a party afterwards, and it was, no, that would be way too different.
Great. It didn't take 6 days for that. One day here is enough. Okay, well, I hope this was okay. And I was so inspired by this 16 steps, this practice that we did during the retreat. And I didn't know how talking about 16 steps would work in an evening when I'm tired. And it was a long week. So hopefully it was, you know, something that was meaningful for you, and that you'll give your breath a second chance. Thank you.